Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and you're listening to Conscious Business Radio on the Transformation Talk Radio Network. Today I have an amazing guest. He's just the most fascinating stuff this person puts forward. His name is Cliff High, and he goes out and does, he does predictive linguistics. And I ask him what it is, and he gives us a baseline understanding of what the science is he does. But he goes out and collects data from all over the internet, literally millions and millions and millions of pieces of data. And then he analyzes it and figures out what our general consciousness is and what our thoughts are, and comes up with trends and predicts what's going to happen in the future. And he's scary accurate on these things. Depending on what it is that he's looking at, he's more or less accurate. He knows how accurate he is. It is fascinating. It gets to, you know, he does mundane all the way to strange. He does, as far as it just the data falls out and whatever comes out. And it's amazing what, you know, it's from the stock market to gold, silver, what's going on in the banking world, what's going on in the woo-woo world, as he calls it. There's amazing developments going on in Antarctica and all over the world, and he's going to share these things with us. It kind of indulged my whole X-File side, and I absolutely had a great time with this interview, and you can tell because it ended up being a two-part interview. The first part's going to air today, and then the next part's going to air on Friday. So we dive into this pretty hard. And I hope you hang in here because there's so many interesting things you're going to learn from this guy. So let's not waste much time and let's get right into it with Cliff High. Hi, Cliff. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
I'm so excited to have you on because we're going to be talking about all sorts of interesting. We're going to be expanding our minds, which is always fun to do. But I want our listeners to understand what it is that you do and start there. What is predictive linguistics?
That's an outgrowth of a couple of ideas that occurred to me in the early 1990s when I had a series of experiences with some very large corporations that had very big problems at the time. I was working as a software engineer and a consultant, and I had to examine language and how it was being stored for a multinational corporation. And I had to examine emotions and how they were potentially to be cataloged for a large Central American university. And in doing so, I sort of juxtaposed those two and came up with what I described as the language model. And in doing so, I then went out to validate it, and I was taken down this rabbit hole because I discovered that I was able to see changes in language that were not predictable, were frequent, were regular, seemed to have some minor connection to like astrological sort of changes or astronomical changes with the planets in the solar system, and lunar influences, and refused to be categorized for easy digital use. And so I really started investigating it, and I came up with a number of premises. One of those was that humans are psychic at their core. Everyone is to some degree. And we also have some degree of awareness of that psychic ability. Usually we can put that awareness down to zero. And our awareness of our psychic ability is neither here nor there relative to how universe works. And universe is going to have us express that psychic ability whether we are aware of this or not. And I can get into some of the details. I actually thought for
So
I came across an insight. Oh, go ahead.
was it kind of a theory at first, and then your data started to really show you that your thinking and some of the thoughts you have are proving out to be true because you saw patterns in the data that's showing it? I mean, was
Correct.
that
Correct. Correct.
that's
See,
really interesting.
what actually happened was I was in this earthquake in Mexico City in 93, and I had to sit on an airplane for a number of hours on the tarmac with a bunch of very interesting people as we were all getting out. And I sort of started thinking to myself in order to shut myself out from all of the stuff that was going on. And I came to a number of conclusions, one of which was that the stock market was not based on any number of rational moves by people. We may think that we're doing things to,
Oh, no.
safeguard ourselves for the future and so on. Right, exactly. It's all emotion. Okay, now I know today that it's all computer driven, but back in the early 90s, there was still enough of a retail market that I could determine that there was a lot of people on the very early days of the internet, even then, chattering about the stock market. And there was it was clear in the early days of the internet that money and the talking about it was a big driving force, that it was of interest. It was sort of a sparkle point, so to speak, for humans. And so I started thinking in the airplane, well, since it's driven by emotion, if one could figure out where the emotions were going to lead the herd, one could front run it. I didn't even know the term front running then, see? So, but I knew I could get ahead of that emotional curve, buy the stocks ahead, and sell into strength. And so I decided I could do this based on filtering through the language, looking for these prescient clues that are hidden in words that are chosen because we have to express an emotion, and we're hunting around to find a very specific phrase or whatever that seems to convey that emotion out of us, if that makes any sense at all.
So could you
So I would go and I'd look at the
you could predict what the stock market was going to do. Did it, were you able to make pretty good money until the data or until
I
computers were running it, or you, that wasn't your goal?
Okay. No, that was my goal was actually to stop flying all around the planet as a computer consultant and make money sitting on my butt here in Washington State. And
That's
so
way
that was
better.
my goal. And so over a number Right, that's what I thought. So over a number of years, I wrote this software because it was a big task. The internet was evolving at the time. HTML was new. There was a lot of internet chat kind of stuff. So I had all these different protocols I had to deal with. So it was a lot of work. Basically, I got it to the point in 97 after writing code for probably about 2.5 years, pretty solid. I got it to the point where I had my first run in 1997, and I decided just I had to have a target at that point. I was running in what I call deterministic mode, where I had a set target to hunt down, and then I was looking for anything that would pop up serendipitously via, if you will, a psychic association between words. Now, what I'd initially done was to reduce, I'd taken, I'd been gifted with an English language dictionary, a digital form. I stripped off all of the definitions and just used the word list itself as a lexicon. And then I'd started going through that word list and applying a multidimensional array, computerese here, into that quantified and qualified aspects of emotions, their intensity, their duration, their propagation into the future, and all of this sort of thing. And I put in these values so that I could do.
How did you connect an
Go ahead.
emotion to those words? Like, how did you know you're looking at an emotion?
Okay, so okay,
You know
so
what I mean?
linguistics is really an interesting.
You're
Yeah,
talking to a
this is
computer
funny. No, that's
scientist
key.
too. I know. I'm like, I got, how is he
Yeah.
doing this? Go ahead.
Okay, so there's two thoughts here. Okay. Linguistics is really interesting because no matter what language you study, you learn that people have a base set of words that they become familiar with through their experience of what we may call their schooling, however that affects them within their culture. Doesn't matter whether you're a tribesman in Africa that lives in a hut and does hunting for a living, or whether you're a programmer in Silicon Valley. Or someplace in China, you're all going to have a set amount of words that you internalize, from which you're actually only going to use a very small subset over any given week. And yet we continually step outside of these subsets and constantly are trying to find new words. And the ratio might be that, say, you know 120,000 words. If you're an English speaker, you have that many internalized. In a given year, you're actually going to exercise or use 20 to 25,000 of those. But in any given week out of that year, you're really working off of a base of 12 to 1500, maybe another 1000 if you have a specialized job skill. And then there is this 1 or 2 or 3% that changes from week to week to week. And that's what I was after, was that change. And so here's if you want to think about it, look at it this way. Here's three discrete examples. These derived from the way that the internet developed, because when the internet first started going, becoming available to people, one of the first things that we did was we digitized all of these official records. So for a long time in my work, from 97 through to about 2003, the dominant language form in there was what I considered to be long-term values, because it was language that was all legalistic language, as we digitized vast quantities of stuff and just dumped it for records on the internet. And that has changed over time. The nature of the language now is what I consider to be immediate language, immediacy language, which is all of the people just chatting to each other. And so the nature of what we put on the internet in terms of the amount of words that are showing up new changes in its ratio. But in the early days, it was a lot of this long-term language, so I was able to easily spot the shorter term and the immediacy language. Now, let me give you three examples and you'll see the difference, okay? And so longer-term language is, my former spouse obtained the title to our car as part of the divorce settlement. So that's long-term language. There's some sort of legalese sort of a focus to it, right? Mm-hmm. And then shorter-term language would be, my ex was given the car by the divorce judge. And then immediacy language would be much more like slang, where you would say, my old lady jacked my ride when we split.
Yeah.
Now, they each have a different impact on you in terms of how your linguistic center responds. And if you're sensitive to that, you can actually feel those differences in that language. And in fact, this is really how the really good in the moment performers, everything from trial attorneys all the way down to comedians, work. They work off of getting a feedback of how the people in their audiences are reacting to the particular and precise choice of words that they're using in order to try and create the effect within them. So a jokester is one guy who just reads a funny story and he tells that funny story and hopes you laugh. A comedian is somebody that gets a feedback from you and alters the telling of that story so as to get the words that more resonate to create that feeling and hype it up and get more of a feedback from you. And there's a real difference in the art, and we can all experience this when we see the difference between someone who's just a jokester on stage versus someone who's a true comedian, or in a trial, you know, a new attorney who really is just using the language but doesn't and then versus the fellow who knows he's trying to achieve an emotional response. And all language is about communicating emotion. So it all gets all stirred up in there. Makes sense?
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Cool.
Okay. So as a software guy, what I did was I decided I needed a base of understanding. There was this a really good guy, Pluchik, I think he was Polish, and he came up with what he called the wheel of emotions in like the 70s or something. And I took his idea, but I altered it significantly from a yogic perspective, because what I needed to do was to determine the difference between what I called building tension language and release of tension language. And so Pluchik's wheel works, but it didn't work for me. But it's basically a multidimensional array presented in a circular wheel, kind of a concentric ring fashion. And I took it and altered it, chopped it up into a multidimensional array, and coded it into C++, and swung it into my programs here. And I compare words against this, against the themselves within the lexicon, based on the if you will, on the static or the sort of static values I've assigned to the multidimensional array that I developed from Pluchik's wheel. And then I compare them to those same kind of values in the words that are swirling around that word in the immediacy of the moment. And so I could look at a word, let's choose a word here, greed. Okay, so greed is a nice emotional word, but it's also can have some distance to it. And so we can look at that word, and I see it within the database. I see that if we're looking at a greed focus, it's more of a long-term value. You have to work to be a little bit greedy. It's not as impactive as the word, say, impulsive. And so there's a certain characteristic that goes along with the word greed. If I go and see the greed word showing up in the databases, then I know that, oh, hey, look, some kind of a long-term value is working its way out. Again, sort of makes sense.
Yeah, so you're looking for patterns of words that are new. What ones are new and popping into the consciousness of people and being used?
Correct, that have to get out
And
because my supposition is that all people are psychic and they have to leak this stuff out. If they don't do it consciously, then it comes out without their awareness through
interesting.
their fingers because our most immediate way of getting it out is through the linguistic center. And so what I actually do from a practical viewpoint as a programmer is that one of the first things I did was I wrote a bunch of these spiders that would go on out. And at the time, they actually hopped from server to server to server because we were basically talking a bunch of Linux or Unix machines. And you would check the robots.txt file. And if it was allowed, you'd run on that machine. We don't do it that way anymore, of course, because it's all HTML based, really. But in any event, what we do is we look for the differences in the standard usual conversation. So if you'll check, you can validate this by using any of the number of cache vehicles that are out on the internet, but just choose a forum, bread baking, gardening, any of these mundane forum, and go in there, pick a particular word for a conversation, like whole wheat bread in a bread baking forum, and just follow those whole wheat bread threads. And just jump, say, every 5 months. And you'll notice that there's a subset of 90% of all the words about that are the same over those months from month, every interval you choose. But then for whatever reason, there's 10% difference. And so my data spiders grab us that up that 10% difference, compare it from week to week, and Bob's your uncle. We're starting to build a model space.
Oh, that's excellent. And now, do you look at what everything like Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and Pinterest? I mean, what do you look at?
The Twitter feed is marvelous because it's real time. We get a great spew of the real internet chatter off of there, and a bunch of the Tor feeds that are Twitter-like, that are real time. Facebook, it does us less good anymore since the introduction of the heavy ad base and their filtering. So I've dropped Facebook in the last couple of years as anything meaningful. We don't actually go there directly. Okay, so the way the spiders work is that they're allowed to go down a certain number of link levels before they have to return and then go back onto the main thread. If they were to go to one of our sites, jumping off points, and get redirected through one of the internal links within that site over to Facebook, it'll go and follow that a little ways, but not very much once Facebook is identified. The reason that this is the case is because Facebook started exercising conscious control on the language that they were allowing to be shown
Yes.
a number of years back. I want to say maybe 2010 was when I really stopped basing anything on any of the social media at that level.
So you
Okay.
can really
And it
tell
was
what
because I started noticing.
you can really tell what systems are controlling language. I mean, big time. You can tell us what ones do it the most, what ones are open, what ones are you can get the best data from.
Sure.
And wouldn't different environments produce different? Because some, I almost think that social media is getting us to a point where we just keep reinforcing the same stuff because people are in their own little world. So different environments would create different, or is it, like is YouTube kind of a whole array of everybody versus LinkedIn would have more all professionals.
You're quite correct. It has a tendency to make these little confirmation bias bubbles
Yes.
or exclusionary zones. We do tend to drill in or be spiral, which is not good for humans, but boy, this is great for data. Okay, because here's the
Yes.
thing. It means that I'm able to easily identify not only the context in which the language is being stated, but I know instantly the kinds of biases that are being presented and whether those biases are officially allowed or supported on that platform, and thus I know if they're being suppressed. And also, it means that I'm able to throw these guys into what we call entities or linguistic structures very easily because it's as though the language is almost becoming self-isolating in a way that did not exist prior to the rise of what we call social media. So in the Wild West days of the early part of my project from 97 on through, say, to 2008, it was an entirely different operating environment because we were not so self-selective in this. And if you will, it was very much more Jamaica Street Fair than New York City Market.
It's so powerful. Back in the day, I was responsible for all the systems development for US West, Beck Telecommunications Company. And so I did all the data modeling across their entire networks. It was the high speed. We had 75% of the frame relay market, which was the backbone of the internet. And so, and then I ended up teaching Bellcore engineers how to do the data modeling and stuff. So what I'm hearing from you is so fascinating, because I know, and I don't think listeners realize this, how powerful and how much information you can get from data. And you're taking it a whole nother step forward, which is absolutely phenomenal, because now you're even proving that there's more to us, and and you're seeing the patterns of it. Now, how often is our consciousness off and not true? Like we all have some consciousness and it just isn't true. Like, for example, at one point we all thought the world was flat. And so our consciousness was a flat world. And then we all thought the world was, you know, round, globe. And so our consciousness was that. So, you know, we can all collectively think in a backwards way.
Sure, we can be all quite wrong about things, yeah. Well, actually, just as an aside, since you have had the Baby Bell experience, I was in with Intelco and a part of the original SS7 team that did the billing and rating channel that allowed all that to occur.
Yeah, isn't
so
that fun?
So I was there when we took telephone from analog to digital, yeah. Anyway, though, your issue about the consciousness is quite correct. I can't answer that, because the problem, of course, is that it's my consciousness that we're filtering all this through with the array of data elements and the way that I built my emotive reduction engine on the language. Because basically what I did was to provide a quantifying and qualifying numeric set for emotions tied to language. And so because I assigned those words, it's my understanding of this. So I can easily be masking all kinds of effects. There's tons of stuff I'm certain I'm not getting simply because we're working through my own mental filters. Now, I know that there's competitors out there in the predictive linguistics space that are doing entirely different things. And these people have a tendency to pop up and then go dark. So there was a Recorded Future funded by Google, I believe, and IntelQ. And they're doing the same sort of thing as I am. And I also run into a lot of the other people doing it, so to speak, with Twitter and in the Twitter feed. So you see how a lot of people are starting to try and do predictive linguistics off the Twitter feed itself. I don't know how their approaches are going, but they're undoubtedly going to discover things that I have not, simply because they're not working through my own set of filters on this.
Well, and it's how good you are
in terms of being wrong.
Well, it's how good you are with the science, right? And how and creating a model that is good.
And actually, I tried very deliberately to allow it to express itself. I wanted to discover what was going on, not try and create a model. And so I've stayed out of that mindset the way that the academics do it. So bear in mind that if you're trained in our school system, you basically have been presented with what we call the scientific method. Okay. And that scientific method can be easily expressed as state a theory, use the theory to project potential future results, design an experiment to see if you can create those results, and to validate the theory. And that's a very fine as far as it goes, but it's extremely limiting. And so my approach was to stop and observe and see what direction the observation took me before trying to create any postulates or premises upon which I think I'm operating. And so I discovered a lot of things before I actually started doing anything. Actually, like I say, I started this whole thing the way to make money and never did, because I was derailed the very first time I did the full-fledged run in 97, because I was after Stanford University Networks Company, Sun, you know, Sun Computing.
Sure, yeah.
And I wanted to see where the stock was going. This was in 97 as the tech boom was starting to ramp up before the 1998 long-term capital management fiasco and all of these kind of things. And I was very ignorant about stocks and money at that time, but I knew I needed to make myself more, to educate myself about it. And I thought this was a decent approach to finding out what was going on in terms of being able to predict. And that was my theory at that time, was that, oh, look, I could create the software, predict where the emotions are going, go buy the stock ahead of time, and then sell it into strength as the herd followed me there. And that was really as far as my thinking had gone. And then the very first run I did, I discovered that there was tons of stuff in there about the sun, not the Stanford University Network Computing. It was about Sol, the big scary ball in the sky. And it was like, uh-oh, I made a mistake. I didn't want any of that. I just wanted this economic stuff. But the problem was I started looking at that data. And then I also discovered that there were all these weird, interesting cross ties from that data over to stuff that I'd never even considered. And, you know, I started going down to down into the rabbit hole. And the next thing you know, I'm in the woo-woo world looking at data sets pointing to crash of the dollar, 20,000 Dow and $600 an ounce silver, which I stated on radio in 2003, and Antarctica popping up as perhaps the solution to humanity's major problem, which is going to be an ice age. And all this stuff started throwing itself at me between 1997 and 2005 or so.
And you were, what is this? Now, when did you start realizing that this weird stuff was true? Like most of the stuff that our consciousness is feeding and our subconscious and our psychic ability is mapping to things that are really happening. Like you started seeing something bizarre and then it would happen.
Oh, that happened over the course of 1998, because the run in 97 took me, oh, I don't know, maybe 2.5 months to actually accomplish the gathering of the data, shoving it into my very crude database forms, much of which I had developed on my own. Then once I had the data, I had to write all the processing programs. And of course, in doing that, I went through and processed through my very early run, which was, I think, maybe only 10 or 20 million reads, each read of 2,048 words. Each word was allowed to have up to 256 characters, each word or phrase. And so I had certain constraints on me for storage that really sort of informed and defined my system at that time. But in 98, in the course of writing the processing routines and extracting stuff out of the data, basically playing in my big data sandbox, I came across some things that were pointing at quite clearly what would smack us all in the face a little bit later, which was the long-term capital management collapse. And so that was like a big, well, duh, something here. And then I went back and looked at the data, and it was a damn look. The data was showing me these elements when I first did that run. And I'm going to guess at this point, because I didn't keep notes at that level, but I could probably calculate it. But I guess I was shown maybe 11 months before there was any public hints even that there was a problem with this. There was all kinds of stuff about the Russian market going bad and ruble manipulation and all sorts of things going on that, of course, at the time I would have discarded anyway, had it not been that I happened to be running that particular kind of processing when it all broke in 98, when the story started coming out. Sort of makes sense?
Yeah,
so
it does.
So time slapped me upside the head. Okay, and that's what really told me I was looking at something that was beyond merely getting a hint on emotions, but it was in fact something that was quite prescient and had a very, very, very long-term potential there. Now, of course, that was, as I now know, that was because basically at that point, the internet was almost all long-term data. In 1998, the internet had not spread to the households the way it has now. There weren't a lot of children using it, and so the demographics were entirely different. Most of the new stuff coming on was all government official kind of stuff that they were putting out, you know, for people to be able to search and all different kinds of things. But it was not the entertainment / communication vehicle that we have now, and so the nature of the language actually was what made it be so long term. So over the 98, 99, I was getting values that were showing about the 9/11 and this kind of thing coming up. And of course, I didn't believe it at the time. I thought, oh no, this is crazy. You know, I've gone over the edge, because I'm interpreting this data. It's not like it writes it out in sentences like automatic writing or a Ouija board or something. I just get vast collections of words that seem to cluster around specific things that later on I discover, oh, look, all those words can be used to describe this event that actually happened.
Well, and that's when you started figuring out, wow, this is happening. And then you probably got a lot better at it, right? Then now you started honing your skill set, because now you've had many years now, but Go ahead.
Right. But I ended up screwing up repeatedly. I would screw up repeatedly because I was doing interpretation and I didn't realize a bunch of things. So I didn't realize language changed so constantly that I had to tune the lexicon almost from month to month because new slang was coming in. I didn't realize at the time that I would go through three major shifts in the type of language where we went from the long term into the short term as the internet itself changed. And so short term might be considered textbook material for high school kids, right? So there's a big period of time when all that kind of material came onto the internet, and there was all these sort of that level of description kind of stuff was being put in place, and infrastructure was being built out, if you will, in data in front of my eyes. And I was smart enough then to recognize it was going to happen again as we got more into the chatter stage, where we're using the internet not merely as a reference and a resource, but as a communication vehicle. And then I also saw that, oh, okay, something else is going to happen here. And then the data pointed me at that in 2005. And later on, it showed up as being the Satoshi white paper in 2009 and the formation of Bitcoin. And so way back in like 2004, I got the indication that we were going to go through these changes. We were going to have a context change in language from long term to short term. I saw that occur. And then it dawned on me, okay, we're going to have to go necessarily from short term to immediacy value. And then from immediacy value as a communication vehicle, we're going to have to go to something else. And I bet you it's money. And sure enough, there we go. We've got our internet of money, or the money of internet, which is Bitcoin. So I didn't have a name for it, didn't know how it would arise or any of that, but I had hints of the stuff in the long-term data as the long-term data was shifting into the shorter-term data sets. Nowadays, on the internet, there's very little long-term data that's put out. We had a vast dump of it here the other day when the CIA put out the, multi-million records, millions of pages of documents, and that was a little brief burst of long-term data. But in the vast amount of the chatter and stuff, it's not even going to be visible within my data sets as a clump of long-term data. It'll just be swallowed up in what's going on at the moment. So the nature of the internet itself and the data flow has radically changed, but we can still mine the long-term data stuff because I had the algorithms worked out for that long before all of that data was swamped, so I can still find it.
So how much more, yeah, it does actually. How much more accurate are you now than you were before? So, I mean, are you really feeling good about the accuracy now that you've had all this experience and,
Sure. Yeah. I'm comfortable. I'm content. I'm at about something that I've had people that would say that, it's as high as 58% in the general language in terms of the forecast I make. I just say that I'm about half of what we discuss in the reports I write shows up to be accurate, excuse me, in some form over the period of time described. And I can also tell you what my error range is on timing. And here's the way it actually works. In the early days, I was very, very, very accurate, quite spectacular so, with all of the long-term data, and even had the accuracy with timing. So for instance, I was able to nail the big East Coast power outage in 2003, wrote up a big write-up about it 3 weeks before it occurred, and said it would have happened between this point and this point, and sure enough, it did within that time period. But at the time, in early 2003 and stuff, there was not a whole lot of not a whole lot of data to support immediacy kind of predictions or short-term predictions, just because of the nature of the internet itself. So at the time, I was writing reports that would be three and four and multiple hundreds of pages and take nearly a whole year to do, because it was dealing with all this long-term data that was way out there. Mm-hmm. The accuracy was very spectacular then. It was still only about half showing up, but because we were dealing with much more longer-term stuff, we would be accurate about the item and the event and the time, but not about the full spread of words we'd used about it. And so nowadays the accuracy is different because we're dealing with much more shorter term and immediacy values. The accuracy is still about half, but we have a tendency to have the full sets, the fuzzy sets we're dealing with of the words that are attached to a particular event or time be accurate. And then the next event is not. And so it's a clean hit or miss kind of a thing. So the nature of our failure, so to speak, or our correctness has actually changed over time.
So it's correct in the sense that it's in that you're in the right genre and topic. It's just because it's so short term and people, things change so fast and emotions change so fast, you're a little bit behind the eight ball on getting to that next event that's going to happen. It's just not possible.
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
That makes sense. Interesting. Okay.
Well, they sort of fade into one another. Yeah.
Interesting. So you can really get to the nut of it. It's just everybody needs to know that the emotion and the politics and things change so quickly short term that, yeah, we'll get some of it right. But the stuff that builds on this might not be because of the way that the reaction might be different. Okay. Well, cool. Okay.
Correct. Exactly. So, yeah, yeah.
Well, let's start talking about what your stuff is coming up with, though, because that's absolutely amazing. I've watched a bunch of your shows and I'm just floored with some of the things that you're talking about. And I want to talk about some of the political stuff and the financial stuff, and then I want to, and some of the technology, but then I want to get into some of like our history and this, all the really fun stuff. So can you first start? I'm going to ask you a question about Trump. What is your data telling us about Trump and the current political climate, because it's really out there right now?
The okay, so our data sets, I have a tendency to filter out and discriminate on personalities, because personalities are usually a situation of you either love somebody or hate them, and so it's a black and white. There's no nuance, and I really need the nuance level for you to be able to express your psychic connections on this. So the way we approach it is a little bit differently, or a little bit different. So there were all these people running around saying that, you know, oh, Hillary Clinton would win. And I said, nope, that's not going to happen. Trump's going to win. And here's why, or rather, here's what will happen afterwards. And sure enough, that all happened. And my understanding of it is, especially as seen from the data, is that the Trump personality is less important than what's going on at the moment that put that personality where he is. And so from my viewpoint, what's much more important is the underlying battle within what's called the deep state. And so this really cool woman, Catherine Austin Fitz, made a statement back during the election and said the only way that Trump is going to win is if the significant portion of the intelligence community decides that it shall be so. Well, she was quite correct, and a significant portion of the intelligence community decided that it shall be so. And they did it for their own reasons. Now, this is where we sort of depart politics into the woo-woo sort of thing, because this deep state is intimately and inextricably involved with all those people working in holes in the ground, reverse engineering space alien technology and all of that. And so they have their own agenda, and they're responding to some of that woo-woo, and their response was, we can't have this other crowd in charge. And I don't think that they are political at that level as a collective. I think that the deep state acts as a much more rational organism and as a committee kind of a thing. And so they're going to favor those elements that favor their ultimate goals. And they saw that things were not going, a certain significant portion of them decided that things were not going to go well with the existing crowd that had been in charge, the neoliberals and the neocons that had been in charge for the past 40 years, and were facing significant crises here. And so they said that we basically need to cooperate or harmonize with what universe wants. And that's why they chose to put in the Trump crowd. And so, but it was not Trump winning. You know, you don't want to take it away from any individual, but Trump, Catherine Austin Fitz is quite correct. Trump could not have won had the military intelligence community not decided that it would be so. And so under these circumstances, I don't separate it from the other things going around here. So one of your questions was, will Trump make it through his term? And see, we can get stuff on celebrities, and I just don't do that, because I did it once for a very famous individual. You have to have a certain amount of fame on the internet in order for me to be able to get enough data around you for me to be able to do a prediction. I did this. It was very sad. It had to do with the man's wife. She died.
Oh.
There was nothing we could have done. And so since then, I just don't do personal stuff. I just will not involve myself in that. But in this instance, I don't deal with Trump, the personality, but I know that the Trump administration, insofar as the length of the time within my long-term data set is concerned, is still out there causing problems. So, and that's 19 months. Long-term data seems to have a very effective range of about 19 months. So from the point of this past run here, or the run I'm in at the moment, out 19 months, we still have a Trump administration out there causing problems for what we can call faction A of the deep state. It was faction B, the breakaway part, that won and put Trump into power. And so there, for the next 18 or 20 months, it's going to be very chaotic, and much longer than that, I'm quite sure. But here in the USA, we're going to have it very chaotic because we have a necessary cleansing that has to go on at many different levels as faction B consolidates power. And so what we've witnessed here is very much as though the conquering of a country or a nation you might read about in, say, if you were reading about Alexander the Great and how when he was a kid, he goes on over and when his dad's out of town. This actually happened. Alexander, when his dad was out of town and left him in charge, he takes his army over and kicks the crap out of the city state a few counties over and seizes control and stuff. But he was young enough to not recognize that he needed to actually exercise control. And there are these steps you go through after you conquer. Yes. And so that's what we're going to be going through here as Faction B consolidates its power and removes the danger elements in Faction A.
Interesting. Okay, so now when you're...
So Trump's still out there, but...
Now, are you learning through your data set that there's... Because right now we have so much uproar and conflict and whatever. Now, does your data set tell you that someone's fueling that column A, group A?
Sure, are they fueling it?
Does it show you that? Go ahead.
It shows us that in how the language emerges. So I can quite easily see what used to be called talking points. And you can actually cluster around it and see what's going on, and I can isolate it. And so I was able to track way back when, maybe... February, March, April of last year, I was able to track the emergence of the talking point agenda that would be used against Trump long before they really started pressing that agenda out. And you could see that it was organized. So yeah, I see this kind of thing. And within the data sets, you see that there is indeed a component of insurrection, or whatever you want to call it, conquering or contention, that's involving the money centers here. And there's a lot of people that are desperately afraid they're going to lose power. And underneath them are a lot of people that are very, very desperately afraid that they're going to go to jail for all the evil things they did for those people in power.
Yeah, well, some of those people need to. We all know there's a lot of high level people who did bad stuff that didn't get in trouble for it. And there's we know it's just right. A really corrupt. So does your data set show you the corruption that's going on and the patterns
oh,
in
sure.
that? Oh, geez. So you get to see a lot. It's in some ways,
yeah,
it's
actually,
hard
though,
to look at, I would think.
It is. It makes the job very tough that way. And I actually have to watch myself that I don't shy away from it and avoid something and not put it in if it's going to end up being pertinent. And so, but a lot of those, insofar as the corruption is concerned, you can actually look at, or some of the language I got out of the early shift into monitoring China Pop, the population in China and all their websites, I was able to start getting the prescient hints about the Chinese capital controls. And that was actually, because of the way the language evolved, that was almost a primer in how linguistically to track the emergence of corruption within the language and thus also the exposure of it. And so shortly after going through that experience and dealing with the forecast for capital controls out of China, I was able to apply these same new tweaks to my algorithms. They're actually it's predicate calculus in Prologue. And I was then able to suss out the Australian population problem that they have now with corruption that will be ongoing for a number of years. And it was even able to tie it to foreign real estate and some of these other aspect words that showed up. So it's been fascinating, the different cultures showing us different aspects of how language informs the way that we perceive the cultures and the way they perceive themselves. And I can isolate some of that, and it aids me in going forward. So it's been absolutely fascinating these past couple of years. I mean, it's been hellacious. It's been a lot of work, but I think we're on the cusp of this next evolution of it all, and it's just, as I say, quite fascinating. Just
oh
not enough
gosh, I
hours in
can't
the day.
Even. Oh, I well, we're in the best time to be alive, and so you're getting to see all this stuff. It would just be amazing. You're probably feeling want to almost pinch yourself that you put yourself into this, and you're so lucky to be there, being able to see, because learning new things and seeing, and as we get into more of this stuff is. And being on the cusp of that is just amazing. Well, I'm going to talk about money a little bit. I've had different experts tell me that behind the scenes, geopolitically, there's three factions that are fighting over control of the money supply over the world. What is your data telling you?
That would certainly fit. I would see that as being very accurate. And I don't know that I've identified the same three factions that they have, but it appears as though there is a old group A and an old group B and a new breakaway civilization group. So I'm actually seeing it as though all of the people that have been working in the holes in the ground in the Western countries for all these years, reverse engineering all the space alien stuff and dealing with all of that, have more or less all pooled together and form a third force that's trying to deal with the issues of the money. We have an interesting common join between all of those at the conspiracy level, which is the thing that drives them, the driving force for them. But I would agree with your previous guest assessment that there's three large groups that are fighting over this.
Well, when you look at the group, the third one, the new transformation group, now are you seeing, because they're involved in the underground tunnels and aliens and all these other things that are going on that the regular public does not get to see, and we're all trying to figure it out. Now, does your data tell you what's actually going on with that world?
It doesn't. Okay. What I get, it might be a list of 20 or 30,000 words. And then I get a list of those. Then I get a listing of emotional values on those words. And then I get another list that ties all those words to various subjects or context. So it's not like the data tells me that. I have to do a lot of interpretation. I'm frequently wrong. I probably contribute to being half wrong all the time. And if I'd only get myself out of the way, maybe the data is a lot more accurate than I would even suppose. But to the point of your question, I bet you I'm getting maybe 30% of what's going on, because a lot of the stuff I'm getting is it's all based on a prescience or a woo-woo connection between words, as opposed to looking for conscious expressions. So it's not like I'm actually sweeping the internet and finding some secret conversation between spy and his master about what's happening in Antarctica. It does not work that way. But what I do get is months and months and months in advance of any of the stuff showing up in WikiLeaks with the weird photographs from Antarctica and their fascination on it. Months before that, I mean like 18 or 19 months before that, I started getting Antarctica showing up, and I would get the word Antarctica with space aliens and Antarctica with pyramid and Antarctica with mountain of coal and Antarctica with hidden technology and so on. So these words are clumped enough in sets that I read them, so to speak, by putting in the articles, adverbs, and so on that I usually put into the reports themselves to string them all together into a coherent sentence, because I have before me the model space that allows me to say that, oh, look, this is the major set, Antarctica. Within there is a subset. Oh, it's alien technology. Within there is another subset. Oh, look, humans discover alien technology. And then there's another subset under there. Oh, humans misunderstand what they're looking at.
So, well, that's probably common.
That's the kind of stuff I get.
Well, how about the missing trillions?
Yeah, and see, it is. It's they are into the deep dark holes. They're into the breakaway population. It needed a seed to get out. It needed needed to have some level of financial security, so to speak. So if we thought of it as the kid living in the basement, it decided that was going to be its graduation gift.
Oh, that's great. So because just back in 2015, there's another $2.7 trillion misappropriated from the military. It's on their site. So, they're taking trillions. What are they going to...
Well, Catherine Austin Fitch says that there's probably 40 trillion missing. And then if you actually look at the totally off books money. So, for instance, all the money that the government makes from running drugs, all the money that the government makes from incarcerating people in the private prisons, and all these other off-the-books money-making, it's probably on the order of several times the 40 trillions. And you can imagine that this is going to be necessary because those floaty triangle ships are really expensive. And you know, you got to pay people to do that at this stage. So they need every dime they can get. Their goal, insofar as what I'm getting from the data sets, would suggest that there's something that's motivating them that we could say is vaguely within the level of fear as an emotion. And that this fear, that whatever it is that's driving them, has presented a timeline that they figure they've got to get active in. And so that's why they decided to shake things up, put in... allow, you know, have a faction B win, change the political structure, and capitalize on that effort. And that's sort of what we're getting out of the data sets around this breakaway population, so which is also, by the way, in the popular woo-woo world, it's called the Secret Space Program.
Yes. I've interviewed the secret, some people from the Secret Space Conference last year. But why, what is, your data is not telling you what the fear is. It's just that they're driven by some fear, and it's something that's a time horizon that's not too
well,
long in the future.
Okay, here's the problem. Yeah, okay, it's not too long in the future. So there's been an uptick in the level and urgency, and a shortening in the duration, and the and an uptick in the emotional impact values. But here's our problem from my data sets, okay? Even if these people knew, all right, let's assume that the breakaway population, because of the way in which started it up, it's like all of our government organizations, it's all compartmentalized. So you know what you're allowed to know, and that's basically it. You think you're told a realistic view of the world. You rarely question that view of the world and whether you're told all of it. And so that really shapes all of your impressions. And so even if you... So you have a fear, you're sharing the fear that is coming down to you from this hierarchical organization, and you're just making the assumptions that you know everything that is informing the fear of your superior, who also made you afraid. And your thinking about this is such that I pick it up that you're afraid of, let's just say, the Anunnaki, okay, coming back to Earth. And then we get another set that says that, you know, they're coming back to mine gold. And then in another set, independent of that, we also find that there's more of this fear language. It's also around the Anunnaki. And there's other people that are afraid of the Anunnaki coming back to take their possession, which is Earth. And then we have another set that shows the Anunnaki more fear and an even further greater depth of fear of that, of the Anunnaki coming back to claim their property, which is humans. Humanity, because they, you know, within this fear-based paradigm there, humanity was created by the Anunnaki, who are somehow going to come back and make a claim on us. Although that presupposes all kinds of things, like a court to make that claim in, you know, a judiciary, a protocol, and all kinds of things. But you see how, in my viewpoint, all of those could be legitimately thought of and felt and be presciently leaked out as being true by the individuals that are involved and be absolutely totally inaccurate. So I cannot assume that I'm getting a clear picture,
I'm
getting lots of a picture.
So you're getting a lot of messages. You just don't know what's true and what's not. But there's something going. You see the pattern of fear. You see the pattern of something going on. And
correct.
You see the pattern of an intense focus on getting ready for something.
Correct. And that the time is short and, you know, we need to get moving and all of this kind of stuff. So that sort of stuff, I buy 100% out of the data because it's at this base emotional level. And those descriptor sets that come out of that are really actually reacting to our bodies. And this has to do with my discovery of the idea of building and release tension. And so within the emotion wheel, whether you're using, you know, the Polish guy, Pluchek's wheel or anybody else's approach to this, you'll find that you can easily separate those emotions out to those emotions that create a building tension within the body and those that that come out as a release of tension, noting that neither of those are good or bad. They're both actually both good and bad. So you can have release of tension where you're just suddenly shocked and because you've been in a car wreck and, you know, you're just freaking out, you were almost killed and so on. That's release of tension. You can also have that same release of tension about that same car wreck be absolutely 100% positive when you realize it almost hit you and you escaped it. So the release of tension is neither good nor bad, and it could have a good or bad focus depending on the event itself. And I use some of the tension release factors, building and release, to determine what is the nature of the event that's ongoing that causes this language to come out. Boy, I sure hope that made sense.
No, that made sense to me. I'm hoping listeners understand it, but this is an absolutely fascinating discussion. Okay, so going on all around the world are these fines in Turkey and Bosnia. You've heard, did you see the latest fine in Turkey? And Dark Journalists aired it. Of the,
yes.
That's just amazing.
Sure, the
Queen Nefertiti.
And Göbekli Tepe. And
that's another one, yeah.
And oh, then, yeah, about that, yeah.
And then the Bosnian pyramids and all these things that are going on. Now, this is all colliding with everything's happening at once, which is amazing. So now what are you learning about? Our history is not what we think it is, right? And we're starting to find all these
Correct.
Amazing structures that are showing us, and we're starting to get it. I don't understand why we can look at the pyramids in Giza, see that they're aligned within a millimeter to, you know, high lines map lines, and aligned with each other and the stars and 20 huge blocks and perfectly without credit. I mean, all these things, obvious marks of machining, and still think it was done by hand tools in 20 years by a bunch of people in loincloths. I mean, I don't.
Yeah. The slave labor approach. Yeah, yeah.
How do they even? It's just to me.
Doesn't come out.
I'm beyond that. I'm like, okay, whatever. That's stupid. Now let's move on to what it really is. But now it's starting. All these things are coming out, and you know, the people who still think that, it's like, okay, if you think that way, whatever. We're moving on because I know it's not that, and I want to learn what's really going on here. But now, is this all tied to what this fear-based thing that we're getting ready for? Is this the Anunnaki? Is this the old civilization? Is it tied to what's going on in Antarctica? Go ahead.
Yes to all of those. Here's how we phrase that, okay? Or here's the concept, the framework I'm putting it in relative to the data. And so what I can do is I can start at the very base level of Antarctica, and I can say that what's coming out of there is a description of Antarctica being the central focus of what we can call the pyramid culture. So the pyramids in Egypt are very small ones. There were probably a lot more that were destroyed by the war that left us the Sahara Desert and all of those sub-Saharan areas that were all scorched. But those pyramids are but a small fraction of the thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, that are around the planet here and on Mars and potentially on many other planets. And those, that's coming out within the data sets, that Antarctica was the central location of this. And it's going to turn out, according to the data, that the pyramid of the two large pyramids that we'll discover in Alaska, the very large one is just ever so slightly smaller than the really large pyramid in Australia, which is just ever so slightly smaller than the main central pyramid in Antarctica.
Well, I hope you enjoyed part one of this interview. Part two will air on Friday at 5 p.m. on the Global Star Satellite, and then it'll go on to YouTube and on 100 different digital channels and on my website at sarahwestall.com, so you'll be able to get that as well. You can also re-listen to this first part of the episode in case one of your buddies, your friends, your spouse, you want to refer this to them, because it's absolutely fascinating. And you can get that at sarahwestall.com as well, also on YouTube. It'll also be, the YouTube link will be on sarahwestall.com as well there. And remember, I have about 150 different episodes and articles up on my website. It keeps growing, of course, each week. And like I said, I have a lot of information that I put with my shows to give you sources, to make it more interesting. So go to sarahwestall.com and you can learn a lot there. And also, I have a little mug on sale. You can support my show by buying this mug. I will have other things that hopefully will go on sale. I'm testing out our little e-shopping cart there and making sure it works good. So I hope for now everybody has an amazing day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. As Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. And learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.